Welcome to the Buckaroo Marketing New Media Podcast, your resource for B2B marketing for manufacturing and related industries. You create unrivaled products and services. We tell your story. Now on to the show.
Welcome. I'm Deb Daly, and I'm the co-owner of Buckaroo Marketing New Media. And today I have a very special guest with me, Dr. Carla Morgan. Good morning, Dr. Morgan.
Good morning.
How are you?
I'm doing well. Thanks for having me.
Dr. Morgan received her PhD in counseling and psychology from Indiana University, and she's had her practice since 2002. And she has two locations, one in Greenwood, Indiana, and one in Carmel. Very, very busy lady, as she has her private practice. She has her wonderful husband, Matt, and then she has four children, ages 8, 10, and 13. Yes, you did hear me say 2 8, so she's had twins there. And what's amazing is she's homeschooled all of them during this whole process. So I'm in total awe of you, Dr. Morgan, that you can even do that. And you still have hair left. I'm just, you know, totally amazed. But as we were in middle of shelter in place, just so everybody knows, Dr. Morgan and I met at a local video event here in Indianapolis. And my colleagues and I found her to be so informative and the wisdom. And I think she just said, she just created a different perspective on some things that, you know, we had not thought of. And so as a result, I wanted to do this. So as we're getting back to business and we're discovering our new normal, whatever that is, I've invited Dr. Morgan to speak with us today. So with that, Dr. Morgan, I'll turn it over to you.
Okay, great. Yes, you know, it was a nice event and nice to meet you then and work with you again now. I think I'm someone in general who doesn't believe that struggle and suffering are things that we need to spend a lot of time trying to avoid, because you know, the blessings that emerge throughout those experiences are often completely unexpected and lovely. So not that it's necessarily fun and painless, but
sure. You know,
pandemic-free life would have meant that our paths wouldn't have crossed. And I suspect that's true for a lot of people in a wide variety of ways. So happy to be here and answer any questions and just chat a little bit about mental health implications of new normal, what things are like for people psychologically moving forward.
So, you know, with that, you know, you talk about, you know, the mental health considerations. What do we need to be aware of as we start back to work?
Sure. Part of what we need to be aware of is what people have been going through in the interim. So what it's been like for people to be sheltering at home, working remotely, navigating a wide variety of personal and professional stressors that are new and different. As I would say, for me as a mental health provider, I have a tendency to look at things on a scale of chronicity with people. So, you know, generally our points of suffering in life are temporary, and we know that. Often we know that in the midst of it, regardless of how intense it is and how challenging it is, that we have a tendency to know this season is a particularly rough one and there's going to be some relief pending. Mm-hmm. So I think keeping in mind for people what their unique experience has been of the shelter at home, which, to be honest, has been all over the map for people, from remarkably treacherous emotionally, involving increased incidences of depression, anxiety, suicidal ideation, abuse, and isolation at home, to people who are exactly on the opposite end of that spectrum saying, this has been lovely, we've had a great time, slowed down life, more family time has been a blessing, been able to maintain our employment, so we're not worried about functioning on a financial level at this point, and everything in between. I think as we start to open back up to life, we need to keep in mind that people have navigated the isolation really uniquely. And therefore, will navigate the opening back up really uniquely from, again, all angles. Some people I'm talking to are so ready to just be out in the world and interacting with people again, loved ones, coworkers, just getting back into their general routine of life that's meaningful for each of us. Other people I'm talking to are processing a truckload of anxiety about getting back into the world. A lot of that around, you know, new normals that we're looking at right now, you know, distancing and mask wearing and trying to avoid getting sick or getting our loved ones sick. But some of it is just about transition. There are certainly individuals who navigate life transitions with a lot more anxiety on a good day than other people. So considerations always in the mental health world are, I think, related to the uniqueness of human experience, that there's not going to be a single right way to do this, but there are going to be a lot of right ways for people to do this. And it's okay for us to just be respectful and patient with each other in this process.
Yeah, I can appreciate that. I know that yesterday I went to visit a client for the first time on site, first time I've been out, and kind of felt weird being in the car, you know, driving to Cincinnati. Sure. But you know, when I walked in, the first thing I said, do I need my mask and gloves? You know, and I'm like, no. And then the COO, chief of operations, came in and said, I need to take your temperature. And so he had the, you know, the little radar gun thermometer and said, yep, you're good. You're normal. And so it's just interesting how little things have changed, because obviously that would have never happened before.
No.
And this particular company has been very blessed in that they've not had any issues, any outbreaks. They've been super just all over it as far as disinfecting and everything. But I kind of found it a little comical, because it's just something that, this is a new one. Would have never.
There'll be a lot of firsts.
Yes. Right? 6 months ago, you said, do you think this would happen? I'd like, no, of course not.
Right. Yeah, our perspective of what's normal, you know, which also brings up, I think, a good point that in general, people are remarkably resilient. You know, the human race is, you know, really good at surviving. And so, you know, what we do is we flex and ebb and flow and we get creative and we grow and develop. And, you know, I think in large part because our points of suffering are generally temporary, and, you know, not to minimize at all the chronicity of human suffering, that there are certainly as many life events that are chronic as there are the temporary struggles that we navigate in life. But because we experience this sort of cyclical experience of suffering and a call to change throughout the developmental lifespan, we do grow in our ability to survive hard things. And, you know, I work exclusively with adults. So that perspective is a bit of a luxury for me, because it's easy for me to sit across from an adult client and say, look at you. I mean, here you are. I know that you're a good survivor because you're sitting here. And, you know, nobody's life up until that point is without their various points of suffering. So you will get used to certain elements of new normal, right? Taking temperature when you enter a building, suddenly post-pandemic fear is no longer massively abnormal, but it's something that we're all going to come to expect for a while. Flip side of that coin is our tendency to get used to new normals is also scary for some people. So some people who fear what those new normals look like, right? And again, you know, there's such a range of comfort level with however people want to frame that up, letting go of their civil liberties, their rights to privacy, or looking at it from a larger community angle and doing the protective right thing on behalf of our more vulnerable members of the population. So one of the things that I anticipate, and we're actually seeing, so my anticipation isn't necessarily for the future, is how much contention people are navigating in figuring out the new normal. So there's a lot of anger. And I think anger is often based in fear of the unknown. But you know, my challenge in general is to ask people to look at this from a place of grace and empathy, that there are a lot of different ways to think about the same experience. There are a lot of different ways to choose to navigate the same experience. And when we get really black and white in our thinking, we tend to get pretty judgmental, pretty closed down. We can't facilitate conversation with people if we're really black and white in terms of the rights and wrongs of life. And while there certainly are those, in this scenario, it's going to be more gray than that. So I'm hoping that, you know, people can figure out kindness as we navigate new normals.
So, you know, you mentioned that you've been seeing contentiousness. How is that, and you've talked about anger as a way to act out other emotions. Talk to me a little bit about, you know, the emotional implications as well as behavioral, as far as how do we act things out. Kind of explain to us a little bit about that, you know, as far as the way our brains work and what makes sense.
So anger can be considered what we call a secondary emotion, or one that people default to when the primary emotion feels too vulnerable. Sometimes then, but it can also certainly be a primary emotion, right? I mean, people have a right to feel angry in a lot of scenarios, but sometimes what happens is instead of expressing fear or sadness or anxiety, we default to an angry expression and behave in ways that look a little bit more controlling or controlled and shut down. So, you know, generally speaking, people are familiar with the fight, flight, freeze response to emotion, and especially the more intense emotions that we don't particularly enjoy. And they are exactly what they communicate. So, you know, we see people in fight mode, kind of coming out in really strong defense of whatever perspective makes them feel the safest, alleviates the undercurrent of the anger. The flight mode tend to be individuals who just remove themselves. So we can see that in ways that are, like any of them, you can see them in ways that are healthy and unhealthy. But when you think about the flight mode, you know, people who aren't in stress, willing to engage in dialogue, but just completely shut down, is equally problematic. And then the freeze mode is basically there's no access to people in those moments. So when we freeze, we stop thinking through how we want to respond, what we have to offer. And so I think implications for that in business settings, when you're working with clients, when you're working with employees of your business, is really looking at what are each individual's default mode, you know, and how does that impact the dynamics of the group that you're working with? Keeping in mind that individuals' default modes are generally not problematic outside of stress. Right. But when we are navigating in increased stressors, and in this case, I would argue increased stressor that is worldwide, that is impacting every one of us in some way, shape, or form.
Right.
It escalates all of our less effective, less pleasant tendencies or coping skills. So I would want to keep that in mind if I had employees, and I would want to keep that in mind in terms of facilitating group dynamics, even amongst clients, if that were part of my role. So when you've got somebody who comes into a group setting from that fight mode because they're navigating big emotion, and you've got other people in the group who are fleeing or freezing and just not showing up for themselves because they're intimidated or navigating their own anger or fear, the group dynamics become significantly less effective and significantly less productive. And then we deal with, you know, more of an overarching psychological impact in terms of just the tone and quality of relationships that people are trying to establish in their work environments.
One of the things that you mentioned, you said as a business owner, we need to be cognizant of, or team members or whatever, we need to be cognizant of their default modes. How do we discover that? I mean, is there a way that we can help assess through like personality profiling or, you know, you've got tons out there, Myers-Briggs, DISC, all those kinds of things. Is it just measuring back to the way the person behaved before the pandemic?
Sure. Well, both, right? So if you have individuals on your team who you've known for a long time, then you may have a clearer sense of how that individual is going to respond to stressors because you've seen it before. So past history might help you kind of assess what it's going to look like in the future. You know, the personality assessments are fun and I think informative. And one of the elements of healthy change is self-awareness. Mm-hmm. If individuals have more information about themselves and the way that they navigate life in general, life when they're stressed, how they navigate making decisions, impacting relationships, that information is helpful in terms of transitioning them contemplating their impact on a team. So, yeah, you know, I think in involving some of that information can be fun. And I think a lot of organizations have, even outside of the pandemic process that we're navigating right now. But I, you know, I would always pose that to people as, you know, I think sometimes people can feel a little bit threatened by having that forced on them. Mm-hmm. I would always pose that to people as, we want to have, you know, some fun with this. We want to just offer information about, you know, self-exploration and awareness and open up conversation as it makes sense. But no, I mean, there's not a right or wrong Myers-Briggs type.
Right.
And I'm not sure people always understand that. If that's not something they've interacted with before and are concerned that it could be used against them. So I would encourage people to communicate the intention behind involving some of that information.
Sure.
And, you know, the goal, like, what are we shooting for here? How do we think this might be helpful?
I know, and that's an excellent point. I know that with one of our team members, I had them do the DISC profile when they first came on board, because, you know, I explained to them that, you know, I just want to know the best way to communicate with you so that you're comfortable. Well, interestingly enough, I am by nature a hugger.
Okay.
She was not.
Okay.
So it was so helpful because I knew that, okay, don't hug this person. And it's not because she's not wanting to be interactive or whatever, but she's just not a hugger. So after a period of time working with us, she came in and she gave me a big hug. And I was like, oh, cool. You know, I've reached another level of comfort.
There you go.
Because, you know, she initiated it. So I think, you know, sometimes just, like you say, just understanding and you bring up an excellent point. There's no right or wrong. It's right. Just sometimes if you can get a little glimmer on how to communicate in a way that person will better understand.
Right.
You know, yeah. you may communicate one way, but they may understand it, whether it's audio or written or visual. You know, we all process information differently.
Indeed. And I think one of the benefits too of that information is it removes the personal from the interaction, right? So if I know about someone I'm interacting with that they aren't a hugger, but that's just part of their disposition and their comfort zone in life, and they opt not to hug me, I can very quickly identify that that's not personal. That wasn't necessarily a personal rejection of human contact with me, right?
Yeah.
When we don't have as much of that information, people do tend to process information through a personal lens.
Right.
So I have used the Myers-Briggs quite a lot, and also the Enneagram in couples work. Mm-hmm. One of my favorite stories in couples work was I had a couple come in who spent the entire first session telling me that they were exactly alike and they couldn't figure out why they were exactly alike. They couldn't make it work. And so, you know, I was like, well, I would like to know in what ways you are exactly alike and what ways you might be different. So, you know, hop online, here's a Myers-Briggs tests that I trust and see what it says. Well, they came back in and they were 100% in inverse of each other.
Huh.
And we all laughed because that was hysterical. They were like, how can this be? You know, just because your personality is inverse of another person doesn't mean that you don't have a lot of commonalities in terms of interests and values. But at the end of the day, just that exercise for them removed the personal. Suddenly he could see her as an introvert and she could see him as an extrovert and understand that their way of being in the world isn't necessarily disrespectful intentionally. And we can think about each other a little bit more intentionally. So I like removing the personal because at the end of the day, very rarely is it. Most of us operate from, naturally, we operate from a self-focus. Even people who identify as remarkably empathic still have a way of processing information through a perspective of self.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, these types of personality assessments, they're just helpful in terms of taking us out of that by offering self-awareness and awareness of others' dynamics.
Mm-hmm.
So I would definitely encourage that if that's something that people's teams would be open to and interested in. But even that, knowing your team, if you work with, you know, a group of raging asocial introverts, it really might not be helpful to personality profiling and assessing because, you know, the relationship piece of that work environment might look really different than a bunch of social extroverts in a sales environment, for example. So, you know, knowing your environment is important there. My husband works in tech and they've been working remotely all of this time. And what they've noticed, and they have weekly, in fact, daily meetings, all of them have noticed they feel more energized, more productive, happier than they did when they were going into the office.
Huh.
So psychologically, what's happening for them, and you know, he would identify himself, but also a lot of his teammates are introverted people. Mm-hmm. And so they are experiencing life with less drain because they're not peopling all day.
Right.
And then can show up with their families or significant others in ways that are more energized. So right. They're happier and feeling more life contentment by not necessarily having to do an 8-to-5 gig Monday through Friday right now. Mm-hmm. So there's a talk there about shifting that. What is this going to look like moving forward, even when we're not feeling massively at risk of everyone getting sick at the same time and ready to bring people back into an environment? I think it will be interesting to see how different organizations figure that out. I think a lot of people will continue to work remotely.
Mm-hmm.
They can. And there are pros and cons to that. There will be benefits and drawbacks.
Yeah, excellent. And that's a great point because I, at one of my client meetings, it was interesting because we were there and then we had the video set up and then we had my computer set up. So we had to link everything so they could see my monitor and, you know, cause one person was working remotely and I really respected them because they were respecting, their team members, you know, wishes.
Yeah.
As far as, you know, potentially working remotely or maybe had something come up that day that was personal or, you know, regardless of whether it was pandemic related or not,
right.
That flexibility was, I was impressed by that. You know, it wasn't like you have to be here and, you know, the iron hammer fist kind of thing. And just really respecting everyone's feelings and place, you know, at whatever point they're in that process. You know, we've kind of touched on technology and we've talked about some people maybe staying home, some people going back to work. Are there other types of changes that you are seeing currently or that maybe you anticipate that we should maybe be ready for or think about?
You know, in terms of industry, I'm not sure. That's not my arena. So the changes that I'm experiencing and seeing in people, it was interesting for me because initially when a few months ago, when everything kind of shut down and everyone hunkered at home, or at least those of us who were not in businesses where we were required to show up in person still, what was happening with the mental health on my caseload was sort of this crisis level, we've got this. And, you know, jumping into coping skills, navigating, you know, just kind of day to day, thinking through, how are we going to do this? What is this going to look like? Doing okay. It wasn't until the reopening talk started that things escalated, at least on my caseload. And in fairness, I work with an outpatient population who were predominantly working from home. So I think, you know, we can also look at that. It was playing out differently in the mental health of individuals who were showing up to work every day, quite likely. But on my end, I think that people started navigating another learning curve, right? What is this going to look like? And a variety of worries and stressors. So in that regard, I think keeping in mind that people are going to be coming back in having navigated, even if temporary, fairly chronic stress for the last number of months. So coming back in feeling a little weary, I had someone say to me, you know, well, so-and-so had, you know, 6 to 8 weeks off. They should be totally ready to come back. And I, you know, my initial thought was, wow, I don't think that people who were called to work from home felt like they were off. So there were a couple of things. And even if people were unemployed during that time, that doesn't feel off, right? That feels remarkably stressful. So it was a different kind of stress. And I think we need to respect both angles of that coming in, but recognizing that people just need to feel heard and validated. So in an environment where people are coming back in, I would just challenge myself to be in that mode for a while, rather than making assumptions about people's functioning. Ask, you know, how are you? How are you doing with this transition back to work? How are you feeling about coming back to the office? How are you feeling? You know, is this something that you are feeling ready for, not ready for? Are there ways that we can facilitate that readiness if it's something that definitely needs to happen? Are there conversations that we can be having about shifting to a different kind of schedule in terms of in the office, working from home? You know, there are so many implications there. Individuals on, you know, in on your staff who are dealing with medical issues or taking care of people with medical issues who may have a lot more stress and worry about coming back than individuals who maybe already had COVID and are doing just fine and don't have a lot of fear about coming back, or are you know, healthy and not super concerned about the impact of getting COVID. So I think keeping all of those things in mind, you know, if you're in an environment that is considering shifting to remote working exclusively or primarily, there's a interesting experience that's playing out. People will say, I feel really Zoom fatigued, like I'm just tired and run down by it, and I miss human contact. And, you know, part of what's playing out there is this concept in mental health that we call the plausible deniability of absence, which is
that's a mouthful. That's a mouthful. Repeat that again.
It is the plausible deniability of absence. And so in psychology, we have a construct of cognitive dissonance, which I think a lot of people have heard of, but in case you haven't, essentially cognitive dissonance is when we have two different ideas that don't align. So if I say about myself, I'm a kind person, and I believe this about myself, this is a construct that's important to me and a part of my identity, and then I go outside and kick my dog, I'm going to experience cognitive dissonance because kicking a dog isn't kind, right?
Right.
So the concept of cognitive dissonance is important in thinking about this plausible deniability of absence that we're experiencing in remote working via video. So what happens when we're in human contact with people face to face is our body processes a lot of that information. we have a sensory experience of being in the presence of another human being, and it's good for us physiologically, right? So isolation, too much isolation, isn't terribly good for us physiologically. But when we're sitting on video with people, we're experiencing cognitive dissonance because our brain is telling us we're interacting with humans, but our body is telling us, no, we're not. Mm-hmm. We're not processing any of that information sensorily in the same way that we might if we were sitting across from someone. You know, I can see you, but I can't see all of you. I can't read your body language. I also see myself, which is really unnatural, right? In human interaction, I don't watch myself interact with people.
Right.
So I'm distracted, I'm less focused. And interestingly, you know, I'm still working remotely because I'm not essentially face-to-face. I'm not someone that needs to be in the face-to-face world yet. My clients have almost exclusively opted to meet with me via telephone, via voice only, in part because they don't like watching themselves via video. I know we can turn it off, but it still feels really artificial. And in part, I think because that plausible deniability of absence messes with people when they're experiencing it too much. Mm-hmm. So ways that we can process that, one is by shutting off the video every now and then and just having voice contact with people. Cognitively, we can remind ourselves, I can say to myself internally, I'm not with Deborah right now. I see her, but I'm not in her presence. I'm not having a face-to-face human interaction with her. We're talking remotely. Mm-hmm. And letting my brain be in the same space that my body is. And, you know, also challenging ourselves in these moments to take some breaks. And, you know, for those of us who have other people in the house, this recommendation can be a little bit easier than for individuals who are living alone and working remotely, but finding some human contact, right? So after a call where I'm on video like this with you, I might want to make sure that I, you know, go find my kids and give them hugs and let my body experience what it feels like to be in the presence of another person. Mm-hmm. So if we're sitting all day, every day on Zoom, the exhaustion that I would experience just from the cognitive dissonance of that human interaction is very real and has a pretty profound impact on the human psyche.
Mm-hmm. That's a really excellent point. I noticed that during this process, different people have been brought into my path, such as yourself, but it's almost been as if, not that I felt like I needed a lifesaver or a life buoy to stay afloat or whatever, but there's just been this sense of community in that, wow, it's really great to talk to someone else. I feel that way too. Wow, you feel that way?
Yes, that validation.
Having that common bonding, even if we're doing it through video, just having that affirmation of, yeah, this is crazy. You know, clients when their kids are, like you said, running through the background. One client shared a tidbit about how his cat threw up behind him and, you know,
oh, no.
During the video, you know, another client's got the dog in his lap and he's licking him to death. And, which in some ways I've enjoyed because it's allowed me to see my clients in a different light.
Yes. Another side of them.
Yeah. And maybe in a more human light. And just the whole conversations, you know, how are you doing? It's not just superfluous. It's not just saying, ah, and then go on. There is that genuine concern
right.
that I've seen across the board that's, you know, both ways as far as how people are doing. Talk to me a little bit about, you know, we kind of talked about change. And, you know, positive or negative, you know, that can produce stress. You know, if you buy a house, it could be a great thing. You're going to, you know, however, the process of moving and lugging everything is going to be stressful.
Yeah.
So how can we help others navigate some of this? How can we, I guess what I'm asking is, you know, what action should we cognitively take to try and help, whether it's a client, a fellow business owner, team member, coworker, you know, what piece of advice would you say that this is something we really need to kind of keep in mind or take action on?
Well, I like your instinct, which is to ask, right? And then genuinely listen to the question, how are you doing with all of this? How is this impacting you? And I think the follow-up question to that is, how can I help? You know, it's tough because there are a couple of dynamics there. When people are in crisis, excuse me, they're often asked, how can I help? And it's a really hard question to answer when we're in crisis. We don't always know. And sometimes the best help that we receive is just someone randomly deciding they're going to do something for us, right? Like drop off dinner or, you know, pick up your kids and take them to the movies or the park or, you know, step in and do a load of laundry for you. So in crisis, you know, I often ask people not to ask that question because the individual in crisis can't always answer it. And so instead, just think of some ways you can help and do that, regardless of what that looks like. Just go ahead and do it. In this scenario, I think what's tough is that to some extent, all of us are in crisis, right? And there's a spectrum there, right? Some people are in crisis in the sense that they're fighting for their lives on a ventilator. Some people are in crisis in that their loved one is deceased and they can't have a funeral for them. Some people are in crisis because their loved one is in a nursing home and they haven't been able to visit without standing outside of their window for months. Some people are in crisis because their kids are suddenly homeschooled and they need to work full-time remotely, which all of which is new. Some people are in crisis because they're jobless, homeless, they can't feed their family. Some people are in crisis because they're massively worried about all of those things pending.
Right.
And so to some extent, every human is being affected by what's happening right now, which is really unique. And so part of what's playing out is where I might have a friend in crisis and I'm in normal life going to step in X, Y, and Z ways. If I'm navigating my own crisis at the exact same time, I'm unlikely to step in X, Y, and Z ways. Mm-hmm. So we have to ask. We have to also be willing to step up and ask for help and recognize, I think, with grace that I might not get it in the way that I need it. My friends or my family or my coworkers or my employer might not be able to show up for me in the ways that they have been able to in the past because they're all also navigating unique crisis points. So I would say that your instinct to ask is spot on. And I would add to that, that our instinct to ask for help has to be acted upon. Lots of people shut that down, don't feel comfortable asking for help, you know, potential rejection pending. But I think in a time like this, when we know that the individuals who typically support us in ways that we're used to or that we've become reliant on may not be able to any longer, or maybe distracted from, we have to ask for help.
And I think the other aspect of that is, you know, some people may perceive that it's a sign of weakness.
Right. Yes.
Or kind of like you mentioned the deer in the headlights. I don't even know what to ask for.
Yes.
And, you know, it's just kind of this whole, you know, and I think it's important that as business owners and coworkers, team members, that we understand that A, we are resilient and we're all in this together. But I also think you mentioned a good thing as far as about being grace and being kind and being forgiving towards one another if we're basically operating at what I would consider subpar or differently than the way we were before, just because of all of this is going on.
Yeah, and you know, with clients, I always encourage people to preface, if we don't know what to ask for, which it takes practice, right? I mean, if we want to ask for help, we have to know two things. One, what is it that we need? And two, what will help remedy it? So, I mean, honestly, having a conversation with people about their needs sometimes requires a lot of work because people don't know what they need. They don't really have a sense of that. Haven't really been trained to think about their needs in that way. So if we know I need help, I don't know what I need, I don't know what will help, then the ask is exactly that. Hey, I have no idea what exactly I need here, but I'm having trouble with this. Can you talk through it with me? And so in terms of communication training, that's where I encourage clients to start with their support people, to be able to say, I don't really know what I need. I don't even know if you can meet it. But right now, I'm struggling with X, Y, and Z. Can you brainstorm this with me? And I think in work environments, that's a very doable conversation if there's a relationship there that feels safe, right? So if there are relationships there that are contentious or difficult or not trustworthy, then I wouldn't recommend that level of vulnerability anyway. But if there's a relationship there that feels safe and you know you're struggling with something, for example, just hypothetically, if someone was struggling with going back to work because they have asthma and they're afraid of getting a respiratory disease, right? Mm-hmm. I don't know what I need. I don't even know if this is brainstormable, but I'm anxious about coming back because of my asthma. Can you talk through this with me? Is a fair ask. Right? That is also asking for a need. Help me figure out what my options are.
Or just listen.
Yeah, or just hear me out on my fears. Yes.
I need to dump my bucket and
that's right.
Get it off my chest. Well, we've covered a lot of material. Is there anything that that maybe we didn't cover that you wanted to mention in as far as in closing?
I don't think so. I think we definitely covered our bases. You had good thoughtful questions. And I think you have a natural inclination to operate from that relational place
mm-hmm.
anyway, in your business life. So, and I think a lot of people do. So I think at this point, that's a strength, a jumping off point for coping with all of the transitions pending and figuring out what exactly new normal is going to look like. If new normal involves more relational, compassionate interaction, then I'm going to like new normal.
Mm-hmm. And I don't mean to like backtrack, but what if I'm the kind of manager that doesn't work that way?
Then you'll always be the kind of manager that doesn't work that way.
I mean, I'm analytical. I don't,
Then you rely on the people on your staff who are. And I think that's probably true across the board, right? So at the end of the day, you're not going to look at any one manager and say, this is the perfect person in all the ways. Because not a single human is the perfect person in all the ways. So what we do, good management would then require us to know, this is one of my pitfalls, and I need to surround myself with people who carry this strength so that we work as a team and attend to all of these variables. So yeah, we're not going to change who people are, but I think something that possibly could change is our awareness of what people need and what their strengths and struggles are and how we can just kind of rally and support around that in organizations to be more effective.
Well, and
the techies work at home so they're not drained all day is good for the bottom line at an organization, then that's going to be a change that happens.
Right. Well, and I think
too, if just a few months ago, it was required that everybody show up every day.
Yeah, and that's something that I've thought about as far as how the business dynamics will change. Are we going to need the big skyscrapers and all kinds of things? But I think the other thing is if you do have someone that's very analytical or, they don't communicate in the way that you're used to, it certainly doesn't mean that they don't care.
No, or that they're doing it wrong.
Yeah, or that they're doing it wrong. I think that's where that giving that grace and that forgiveness and being understanding and compassionate really comes into play because, and like you
to
said.
To me, that's where the contention plays out, right? This assessment that if you're not doing it my way, you're doing it wrong.
Mm-hmm.
Good ways to do life. And that's just the truth. We're all so unique from each other. Even those of us who identify with the same Myers-Briggs type, for example, still play out life in our own unique way. We're not all doing the exact same job and navigating the exact same kinds of relationships or hobbies. So there are a lot of great ways to do life. Making room for everyone's good ways to do life is important. And communicating that there's only one way And that if you're not doing it my way or in a way that suits my way, that it must be wrong. That's where the contention comes in. The anger plays out. People navigate fight, flight, freeze, and it isn't necessary. You can look at that more from an angle of openness and grace and recognizing that other people's good ways of doing it might be really beneficial to us across the board in terms of our relationships, our business dynamics, the tone that's set at work. We need each other.
And this whole process of discovery and communicating is tough.
Yes, it's messy.
Like you said, it creates that own that a stressor of its own. So, you know, do you want to go hit the chocolate and sit and
play? Right.
Or eat the pint of ice cream? Or
right.
Because we all have different coping mechanisms sometimes.
We do. Well, and I think pandemic stress has escalated those, right? And that's been something that you see people joking about, are some of the less healthy ways of coping. But even that, you know, transitioning away from some of the unhealthy ways of coping that people have adopted in their quarantining, social distancing, is going to be an adjustment. So, you know, if you're wrapping up work every day at 5 and pouring yourself a glass of wine because you don't have anywhere to go, so you're not going to be driving, stopping drinking a glass of wine every day because suddenly you've got to do life again. Will be an adjustment for people.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, recognizing also that people are trying to jump back into more functional coping skills that may have gone by the wayside during this quarantine period.
Sure.
It's also a helpful thing to keep in mind.
Well, and I think you bring up a good point. Sometimes it's just even sitting down with that pint of ice cream and going, okay, I know I'm distressing right now and I'm eating the pint of ice cream because by golly, it makes me feel better. And
right.
Just acknowledging
right.
That feeling within yourself, I think, can be very helpful.
Indeed.
In the process. And, you know, it's not just about being kind to other people. I think
but
so much of it is being kind to yourself.
Agreed.
And that's the hardest, I think.
I agree. I think that is universally the hardest. Yeah. And recognizing that, yeah, I am going to eat this pint of ice cream or drink this glass of wine from an emotional place right now, but I'm not going to do that every day for the rest of my life, right? This is a season. It's a really hard one. And giving yourself grace, I agree with you, I think is a huge hurdle for people.
Well, Dr. Morgan, I think that probably is a wrap for today. You know, thank you so much for sharing your time and your wisdom with us. I always enjoy, you know, talking with you. Again, thank you for being with us today. You've been awesome.
You're welcome. I enjoyed it. Thank you.
Thank you for listening to the Buckaroo Marketing New Media Podcast. If you'd like to learn more about B2B marketing for manufacturing and related industries, please visit us at gobuckaroo.com.